This is special coverage of the war in Iraq from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just a few minutes ago, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, concluded a press conference at the Pentagon. NPR's Scott Horsley has been listening to it. And Scott, in the opening statement, Secretary Rumsfeld seemed to address the concerns that many have read in the newspapers about the war bogging down, stalling, that things are not going as quickly or as well as planned, by talking about mood swings in the media, sometimes within the course of 24 hours. The massive volume of TV and breathless reports on TV, he said, can be disorienting.
Well, there's no question that there has been massive real-time coverage of the conflict in Iraq, and that is something that, generals and defense secretaries have not historically had to deal with. There's usually more time to sort of smooth out that reaction, and so Secretary Rumsfeld was on the defensive today. He said it's a little early to be writing the history of this campaign, a little over one week into it. And both he and General Myers stood by the plan, which they said was Tommy Frank's plan, was thoroughly vetted by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the combatant commanders, including General Wallace, who is the one making the comments about now the war probably being longer than anticipated. But Secretary Rumsfeld also, in response to a question, said, why would we try to guess how the Iraqi citizens are going to react to the campaign? Why would we try to guess? And in fact, there were certainly guesses that were incorporated in that plan. The commanders had to make some assumptions about what sort of welcome they would get, both in southern Iraq and as they move further north. And it's those assumptions that I think are now being tested.
And he said, we will find that out, and anticipated that there would be responses across the spectrum, some violently opposed, some wildly in favor, but this will be knowable when it is knowable, and when forces arrive there, and the inevitable American and British victory. He said, I was interested in something General Myers had to say when asked to narrate the first week of the war. He said that we got to Baghdad, the outskirts of Baghdad, as quickly as we did. Asked why, he said, because we could. The goal, he said, was to try to bring down the regime as soon as possible. He didn't say quickly, but as soon as possible, and that the tough part still lays ahead. And then he went on to talk about the importance of lines of communication, those hundreds of miles from the Kuwaiti border up until the outskirts of Baghdad.
That's right. He said that we can measure the miles from Kuwait to Baghdad, and anybody who looked at the plan knew that those were long lines of communication from a military standpoint. We've been hearing a lot in the last week about the raids by irregulars and paramilitary groups all along those lines of communication. Much of the fighting we've talked about in Nasiriyah over the last week concerns supply lines moving to the north. General Myers said that there have been no militarily significant assaults on the lines of communication. In other words, for all of the attacks that we've heard about, he insists supplies from a strategic point of view are getting through. We heard earlier today from Central Command that it's not uncommon for the folks on the ground to have a different view of things, the people that are actually waiting for their new food and fuel and ammunition to arrive. And it was interesting, at Central Command, they talked about that view from the ground level forces being the view from planet Earth. I guess that's military speak for the folks that are actually on the battlefield, but it does sort of beg the question, well, if that's the view from planet Earth, what is the vantage point that others are speaking from?
Yeah. We're going to address the issue of logistics and lines of supply in greater depth in a few minutes, but first on to more, perhaps you might call it diplomatic affairs, and we're going to hear about the UN in just a moment, but there were specific warnings to two of Iraq's neighbors from the podium by the Secretary of Defense, first to Syria, where Secretary Rumsfeld warned them about shipments of military supplies to Iraq that seemed to be going across Syrian territory.
That's right. Secretary Rumsfeld said that would be considered a hostile action and the Syrian government would be held accountable for that. And then when talking about these Badr Corps, these Iraqi citizens who are sponsored by Iran, he said that would be unhelpful to the U.S. forces, and that to the extent that they got involved on the battlefield, the U.S. forces would have no choice but to treat those Badr Corps as combatants.
Hundreds of those, he said, later were in inside Iraq, and they had not made any attacks as yet. Well, Scott Horsley, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
The UN Security Council, we mentioned, has finally managed to find unity on an issue pertaining to the war in Iraq. The Council today unanimously approved a resolution that allows Iraq's oil for food program to be used as emergency aid for the Iraqi people. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urgently requested the resolution. It took the Council, though, a week to produce it, even though all 15 members said it was a good idea. NPR's Vicky O'Hara followed the debate. She's here with us in the studio. Vicky, there was apparently quite a bit of argument about this resolution. What was the problem?
The Council split along the same political lines that kept the Security Council from approving a second resolution authorizing the current war against Iraq. Russia, Syria, France, and China were afraid that the resolution would somehow legitimize a war that they oppose and which they say the Security Council hasn't authorized. They also wanted to make sure that the resolution did not alleviate the U.S. and Britain of their responsibility as an occupying force to take care of Iraqi civilians. And Russia also was concerned that the changes in the program not somehow give the United States control of Iraq's oil money.
Now, does this final resolution address those concerns?
Yes, it seems to. It basically gives UN Secretary General Kofi Annan control of the oil for food program for a limited period, just 45 days. He'll be able to use contracts that have already been approved under the program to provide humanitarian relief. The Secretary General also will be able to prioritize the contracts that exist, you know, singling out the ones that, you know, that are for food, are for medicine, things that are urgently needed, and push those things through, you know, first. The resolution in no way authorizes the U.S. to administer the oil revenue, and it explicitly states that the aid that the United States and Britain, as the belligerents in this war, are responsible for the welfare of civilians.
And we did see today the docking of a ship at the Iraqi port of Umm Qasr, the Sir Galahad, a British vessel, with humanitarian supplies, and that's not connected with this oil for food program. But under the oil for food program, how much money or food is available?
It's a little bit murky. It could be about $2.5 billion. That's what is supposedly in the pipeline in terms of approved contracts. But only a fraction of those contracts are actually for food. Under the existing program, the Iraqi government uses its oil money to contract for deliveries of supplies, and the Iraqi government manages those contracts, so no one except Baghdad really knows where things are in the pipeline. We don't know if the stuff is sitting in warehouses. All of that has to be determined. Mm-hmm. This resolution gives Kofi Annan the authority to contact suppliers and find out where things are in this process.
Now, one word in that program, oil for food. Does this resolution say anything about the future reconstruction of Iraq or the very contentious issue of who will run the country and its oil industry?
No, it doesn't, and that was very deliberate. That was the only way they were able to get this resolution approved in what is fairly short order for the United Nations. After the vote, UN diplomats, you know, made the point that reconstruction is something that has to be dealt with downstream. There is a political split in the Security Council over who should administer Iraq post-war. France and Germany, for instance, say that the United Nations should have that role, that Britain and the United States should not. The United States says that the United Nations obviously has a role to play in the humanitarian side of things, but the U.S. has not said that it would go along with the UN administering the country. In fact, some administration officials seem to be saying that's simply not going to happen.
Okay, NPR's Vicky O'Hara, thanks very much for being with us here in the studio. In about 10 minutes, the president, we expect the president to come out at the White House to make an address to veterans groups. We'll bring that to you live. In the meantime, one of the most contentious issues that we've been hearing about in the Iraqi theater has been the issue of logistics. Joining us now from his home in Virginia is retired General William Tuttle. He's currently writing a book called Defense Logistics in the 21st Century. During the Gulf War, he was the commanding general of the Army Materiel Command. And General Tuttle, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We're hearing a lot of reports about how difficult it is for supply lines to keep up with the troops. Can you tell us how the military plans logistics, and all of this has to be done ahead of time, I assume?
Oh, in fact, this planning for this, I know, has been going on probably a year, 6 months at a very high level. tempo, and it's just a very complex operation because you're planning both for, you know, the air forces and the naval forces as well as the land forces, both marine and army.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go, you know, the complication was coming in through a relatively small port compared to what we used during the Gulf War in Daman and the other and the port north of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a real synchronization problem to try to get everybody in there, because you're deploying and you're sustaining forces right now, as you realize. They're the 40 ships from the 4th Mech Division and its associated equipment and other people that are with it that are just beginning to come into the Persian Gulf now, and I guess will start being discharged on Sunday.
And given that, I assume the hair of whoever is planning logistics now can be found on the floor beneath his desk, because he didn't plan for those ships to be there.
That's right. And so but you're always faced with this in the logistics business, I assure you. War is not predictable. You know, you plan the best you can. You look at alternatives. You do contingencies, both on the operations side and on the logistics side. And but you have to be aware and be ready to adapt to the realities that you face from day to day.
Now,
I think this is not unexpected, what we're having, I think. I mean, certainly the 4th Mech we thought would be coming in through Turkey. But nevertheless, it's not unexpected that 325-mile supply line, I guess, as it is now, was planned for. We knew it was going to happen.
Well, we keep thinking about these lines of supply extending from, the 3rd Mechanized Infantry Division, which
is
up near Karbala, all the way back through Kuwait. But really, you have to think of it as all the way back, to Norfolk, California, and in the case of, I guess, the 101st Airborne, all the way back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Well, most of their supplies, of course, at least some of it, the food, the fuel, the high volume supply and the ammunition a lot of that was pre-positioned in Kuwait, and as I understand it, and because they were, again, being anticipated. Fuel, the big thing. That's a fairly large amount of their commodity they handle, and so is water, and ammunition is the third of what we would call the big three. Food is somewhere down a little bit below that, but that's mainly meals ready to eat, which has been a problem too, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But just getting the flow, keeping the flow going, particularly in that kind of environment where we move so fast in this week, it's amazing they've gone that far. So inevitably, you've got the catch-up problem. So the pause right now is really helpful to the folks. I heard you say earlier about the ground truth or the planet Earth.
Right.
That's your customers. So from a logistician's point of view, you want to make sure your customers always have what they need. They never have to look around to find if it's there or not. And so that means the long haul folks, that drive the long distance trucks coming up through those. You know, up those roads through those nasty cities where they're being shot at, that makes life more difficult. They want to go up there and refill the tankers and the ammunition trucks for both the Army and Marine Corps and as well as the Brits that are up there.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that. Obviously, during your Gulf War, the big buildup was in Saudi Arabia. There was no threat to those lines of supply, as you had to move the stuff from the ports at Dammam and on the coast there to the attack where people were getting ready to make the attacks, and then the leap into Iraq only got as far as Nasiriyah.
Yeah, we had to do some resupply, mainly fuel. Didn't have to resupply much munitions because they didn't shoot much. A couple of battalions did, but it was compared to this operation, that was a piece of cake, I'd say, as complex and as difficult as it was. We had time, we had 6 months in which we set it up, the troops flowed in gradually. We had the first group came in, then the 7th Corps came in December after we basically had established an infrastructure. And as you said, it was all secure. It was going up the pipeline road all the way up into the north of Saudi Arabia, and nobody shooting at you. And so everybody was ready. They had their tankers and their ammunition trucks all loaded up, and when they took off, for 96 hours or wherever it was, they basically, except for fuel, they had to resupply fuel, and that was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
nevertheless, compared to this, it's a cakewalk.
Well, given the challenge of this operation, and from what you can see, and you're not on the inside anymore,
exactly.
We understand that, but from what you can see, how are they doing?
Well, it's hard to tell. All you get is, of course, you get from the embedded reporters, which is a very valuable source. You get the perception of the troops, and as you said earlier, if they miss a resupply of fuel or a resupply of MREs or something, or their wants are fairly small, except to fix their vehicles and those that are maybe damaged. But they will complain, and that's what they should be doing. But it looks like there's no major, as the reports are no major difficulties, and certainly the interruptions of the supply line, it's just like we had in Vietnam. It's kind of the same drill. Once in a while, you get interdicted for a few hours, and you deal with it, and you continue the march. There's always air resupply for emergency things. They can do that with both helicopters and fixed wing air, C-130s. So I would think more of that will happen as they get established in the northern part. Mm-hmm. The 101st already has a base up there, not too far. I noticed from the Washington Post map yesterday, and so they can probably fly 130s into those airfields and carry some of the things like repair parts that are not the heavy, the high bulk items. Or munitions that they may be run out of, a particular kind of rocket or something like that.
Well, finally, General Tuttle, if the forces on the ground consider themselves on planet Earth, what does that make Washington?
Washington is always the bad guy. Okay. And that was our problem back in Gulf War. You know, you do your best in sending the stuff over there, getting it there, answering the urgent, requirements, the inevitable surprises that you get. But they're concerned about it, and they're leaning forward. I've talked to a number of the logisticians who are, intimately involved with this thing, and they're working 24 hours a day to try to, understand what the requirements are, make sure they can communicate them, get the stuff to them, deal with the inevitable problems. So I think it's a difficult challenge. It's just, 325 miles where you're getting shot at is hard in anybody's, language.
General Tuttle, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, you're delighted. Take care.
Retired General William Tuttle of the United States Army. He's writing a book now called Defense Logistics in the 21st Century during the Gulf War. As you might have divined, he was a commanding general of the U.S. Army Materiel Command, and he was speaking with us from his home in Virginia. In a couple of moments in the East Room of the White House, President George W. Bush will give remarks to representatives of veteran service organizations. We'll go live to that event when it begins. Joining us now from the White House is NPR's White House correspondent Don Gagne. Don, good to speak with you again.
Hi, Neil. Thanks.
What should we expect to be hearing?
The president will talk about the importance of service and sacrifice by those who serve in the American military. And these veteran service organizations, it includes organizations, this is just a very, very partial list, the American Legion, the Congressional Medal of Honor Society of the United States, Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States, the Vietnam Veterans of America. The president will speak to them in the East Room now. This was supposed to be a Rose Garden event, but the weather brought it in, and he will tell these veterans that their service has been important, and he will also kind of contrast the way the U.S. Carries itself and behaves during a war with what the president will say we're already seeing in the first week of the war from Saddam Hussein. He'll describe the brutality and horror is the language he'll use, mm-hmm. of that regime in Iraq.
Hard to ignore this setting. What is the message that the White House hopes to deliver?
Well, it's another example of the president in a week where they felt it's important to get him out there and talk about the war and be very visible as the commander-in-chief. He will talk about the progress so far. Expect him to say that it is steady. But they have also this week been kind of tamping down expectations. So no doubt we will hear him use some language that says this will be difficult, that there are many difficult days ahead, and that it's impossible to say at this point how long the war will last.
Yesterday at the joint press conference with Prime Minister Blair, slow but sure. Don, how is the U.S. responding to reports in today's papers that the U.S. military underestimated how hard this could be? This from a quote from a land commander in Iraq.
They say that a general on the ground can assess his situation, but that the war plan is in place, has been in place. They defend it, and they say that it always counted on having to adapt to whatever the Iraqis threw at the troops on the ground. So they are really downplaying. In fact, Press Secretary Ari Fleischer today wouldn't even comment directly on that quote, just saying that the plan is in place and that it is going as expected.
And we heard the quote from mood swings in the media from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. I gather the word at the White House today is silly.
Silly was the word. A senior administration official this morning asked not to be named, but when asked if the president is getting a little frustrated by the questions that are being directed regarding the war from the media, said that the president does think that that it is a bit silly, some of the questions that are being asked. And it's interesting. The question that has been asked often is, how long might this go on? Could it go on months? Apparently, that is one of the silly questions. But Fleischer says that it's the same thing that they saw during the war in Afghanistan, when a few weeks in, people were asking, why isn't it over yet? Well, I can tell you, I haven't heard anybody in the White House press corps ask why this isn't over yet. I don't think anybody has expected it to be over this soon. But the White House has been very sensitive to questioning about whether it's going well and how long it may ultimately last.
We're waiting for the President of the United States, who will be addressing a group of veterans organizations in the East Room of the White House. I'm scheduled to begin a few minutes ago, but obviously in these times, in fact, almost any times, the president could be running a few minutes ahead of or behind schedule. In this case, it's behind schedule. And let's bring Jim Fallows into the conversation. And Jim Fallows, a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly magazine and a former speechwriter at the White House, well used to, in fact, I'm sure, the delays that can sometimes happen about this. But I wanted to ask you about the media message. Earlier today, we heard Secretary Rumsfeld in this article that was in the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times today said, well, he'd seen the headline and he hadn't read it. And then also that he said, asked about, well, is this General Wallace off message with wherever everything is, or this is just his heartfelt opinion, and is he allowed to express it? Have you called him? And he said, look, nobody's telling anybody what to say in any of this. Given your experience, do you find that an interesting reply?
Yes. I think that Donald Rumsfeld is generally known for his frankness, but I think at the podium in those moments, his nose might well have been growing when he was saying that he hadn't read the article and there was no coordination on message, because while, of course, there's always deference to commanders in the field and you want to pay great attention to what they see going around them, I cannot imagine there's not been conversation with General Wallace about the message he is sending out.
And that maybe in his late-night conversations ought to be held with his aides and not reporters from the Washington Post and the New York Times. Don Gagne, was there any skepticism about that sort of thing at the White House briefing earlier today?
Oh, there were plenty of skeptical questions about that comment and how it doesn't appear to fall in line with the kind of things we heard from Vice President Cheney in the days leading up to the war, which said that it would last weeks, not months, and that there would be significant defections among the Iraqis who would not want to fight for Saddam Hussein. One reporter even quoted a letter that the White House sent up to the Hill this week in defense of the supplemental, the request for $74.7 billion to fund the war. And in that document, I don't have it right in front of me, but it talks about the Pentagon anticipating a very short, very intense period of combat before we get to the reconstruction of Iraq. And the White House says, hey, we're a week into this thing, so it's impossible to say that a prediction that it could be weeks, not months, is not accurate. And that has been their position in the light of all of this this questioning.
Jim Fallows?
In the two or three weeks before the actual combat began, I was talking not to military leaders, but a lot of the civilian strategists of this plan. And while they knew anything could happen, I think most of them clearly expected that it was going to be relatively easy. It was going to be more or less like the operation with the Taliban in Afghanistan, that the local roots would prove to be fragile. And one point they all made by way of historical analogy was not simply the most recent example of the Taliban, but also since the Vietnam War, all of the combat, the strictly defined combat operations the U.S. has been involved in, have gone more or less better than expected. The actual ground warfare has been much, much easier than the worst predictions held. And so I think this is the first one that deviates from that trend in 30 or 35 years. And so to the extent they say they're not surprised, that's not wholly believable.
There was a week or two into the campaign in Afghanistan, reports in the media using the dreaded Q word, quagmire.
Sure. That's true, but there were also at the same time there were the films of women in Afghanistan, celebrating that they'd been the jackboot of the Taliban had been removed from their throat to their burqas, and we may yet see those scenes from Iraq. But so I think that's they were expecting to have seen those scenes already. I believe.
Getting back to this idea of being on message, this is not unique to this presidency, this White House. I think every White House wants everybody to be singing from the same page as they are reading from the same page.
Well, just as democracy is great until the Parliament of Turkey goes against you, so too freedom of thought among your administration is great until people start leaking to the press. And I think if there's one constant in all administrations, it's just tearing out the hair exasperation about people getting off message. It had been actually phenomenal that until this point, the only major off-message moment for the administration was the former Secretary of Treasury, Paul O'Neill. Apart from that, it's been an extremely consistent theme we've heard on economic and political subjects.
And it may be significant that he is the former Secretary of the Treasury. Don Gagne, we still await the President of the United States, who will be shortly addressing a group of veterans organizations who have gathered in the East Room of the White House. And you were there in Tampa earlier this week when the President went down to a Central Command, MacDill Air Force Base, which is the headquarters of Central Command. It's also MacDill Air Force Base, but he was speaking there to military members and their families. And I guess second only to an audience of the troops, veterans are about as friendly an audience as the president can hope to find.
Absolutely. And this will just be, in the East Room, a picture of American sacrifice and service, as you see these veterans arrayed there to listen to the president. One other thing that he is going to talk about today, we're told, is how difficult it is for the families left behind when someone is deployed overseas. And he is going to talk about programs that are already in existence in communities around the country that these people can tap into. But I think he'll also be encouraging Americans to be mindful if they have somebody in their neighborhood who has a relative deployed, to see if they can help out.
And in these times, and interestingly, at the Pentagon briefing earlier today, Secretary Rumsfeld was, in addition to his new cautions to Iraq's neighbors, Syria and Iran, not to interfere, basically, he reminded Iraqi officials that how they treat American and British POWs will be something that will be borne in mind, and that once this is over, their treatment of these people will be remembered. And Jim Fallows, that's something that's always important in these kinds of situations.
Oh, of course, and there is the kind of delicacy of the administration. There are all sorts of delicate acts they're trying to carry out. One is the extent to which they can appeal to standards of international law, having so recently had to declare that, well, for all these international institutions, the U.S. has to take the steps that it deems necessary to its national defense. And so it is this is the week for appealing to these standards of international decency. There's one other thing I find fascinating about this moment, if I could, which is the sort of the latest wrinkle in the political military wrestling match of the last 30 or 35 years. And maybe the president is coming, so I turn it back to you.
No, that was another message coming to the control room. We are still waiting for the president of the United States to come to the podium of the East Room of the White House, where he'll be addressing veterans groups. So if you wanted to finish your thought.
I was going to say, I think that if you that in a way the dispute between General Wallace and his civilian, his political leaders in Washington is the latest wrinkle in something that began at the end of the Vietnam War. The famous Powell Doctrine was really the military's reaction to what it viewed as its abuse during the Vietnam War. And the doctrine was they would never again be in a situation where there was essentially any chance that they could lose. And in the debates of the last, say, year within the administration about going to war in Iraq or not, General Powell was often cast as sort of the peacenik, and he was characterized by some of the civilian leaders as being sort of today's version of General McClellan in the Civil War, who just wanted to have all these troops but not use them. And you hear an undertone in the current debate is, oh yeah, the military always wants too many troops. They're always complaining they don't have enough tanks. If you left it to them, they just sit in their garrisons all the time, which is an inversion in the way we think of this debate usually playing out. But that's I'm sure the military is right now saying, well, the reform advocates under Donald Rumsfeld just wanted to make this too lean, too mean, et cetera, and we're left without the backup we need.
And David Frum's book, and he was a speechwriter at the White House, who's one of the few people to leave the administration and write a book about it, but he was describing that very tension that you were talking about in terms of the war on terrorism as those who were the big war advocates and those who were the small war advocates, or the peace Democrats, the McClellan faction, about as nasty a way as anybody can denigrate another faction as possible, and certainly the same kinds of comparisons being drawn up in terms of their response to the possibility of war in Iraq as it developed. Yesterday, interestingly, we had a conversation with a Jeffrey Record, who's written books about Vietnam and among other things, described the origins of the Powell-Weinberger doctrine and as directly a response to the loss to the loss in Vietnam, but he also pointed out that the military blamed itself in part for that loss, and to its credit, he said, and this was part of the conversation we did not get into, went into a long look at its training, at its doctrine, about its inability to fight at night, about a whole number of things. Of course, it transitioned from the draft army in those days to an all-volunteer outfit, and there's been enormous change in the military culture and the military structure since then. But the men who were the victims of what they saw was political abuse in Indochina all those years ago, they're now the ones calling the shots.
Indeed, and I think there's been a kind of interesting campaign within the administration to say that Colin Powell is somehow damaged by that memory of Vietnam. He's not sort of willing to take on the big challenges of the time. When you mentioned the effort of the military to learn from Vietnam experiences, I would argue that in the last several decades, the two great American institutions that have tried hardest to learn from their failures are indeed the military and Detroit automakers. They both have their problems, but they both tried to learn.
The person to whom we turn to when we can't find out why something is not happening as scheduled at the White House is, of course, our White House correspondent. And that was what we were talking about earlier. The message in my ear was that Don Gagne was going to duck out and see if he could find out what was going on. So, Don, any reason for the delay that we know? The president expected to have started, about 15 minutes ago?
No. No specific reason. It is one of the things about the White House. Sometimes the president comes out on time. Sometimes he comes out early. He surprised us a few days ago by walking out 12 minutes early, and he's just used up those 12 minutes if he had them in the bank. Anyway, but he did have lunch this afternoon with Vice President Cheney, and we do know that he was on the telephone with one of the U.S. allies in the war in Iraq, Spain's Jose Maria Aznar, and they were discussing Iraq. Whether or not either of those two things is the reason for the delay, we can't say right now. We're all just kind of waiting for him to walk out. We do know he's heading back to Camp David for the weekend, and he will have his war council up there with him and have his usual schedule of briefings. But this will probably be the last time we'll see him, at least for a couple of days.
Jim Fallows, about that idea, I mean, the first weekend of the war, the president, we were quite pointedly left to Camp David, outside he understandably enjoys quite a bit, but nevertheless, clearly the message to the American people, you know, slow, steady, leave the professionals in charge. I'm going to go do what I normally do.
This reminds me of Ronald Reagan's refusal during his time ever to seem flustered, ever to seem overworked, ever to seem as if he was losing a night's sleep. I would think in the long run, one could take this message somewhat too far of going to Camp David each weekend during a war, but clearly, I think the president wants to have a sense of serene calm, which he actually seems to possess himself. To go back to the General McClellan comparison we were making before, implicitly this is a wonderful one for the president, because if Colin Powell is General McClellan, then he, George W. Bush, is Abraham Lincoln and is standing firm and resolutely for the principles he believes in.
Mm-hmm. Don Gagne, there is another historical analogy we can indulge in while we wait for the president to emerge, and that is obviously to the president's father's administration. And clearly, this has been written about in the media, Ari Fleischer has said that that, yes, he did study what Marlon Fitzwater did when he announced the start of Operation Desert Storm. And, yes, he had gone through all of Marlon Fitzwater's briefings with reporters in those days to see what kinds of questions would come up.
And he went so far as to, after having done all of that homework and all of that research, to have Marlon Fitzwater in for an extended discussion of how careful you have to be in putting forth that public face on the administration at a time of war. And we have always found Ari Fleischer to be very circumspect in what he says, and sometimes his briefings are quite frustrating when you're trying to get some information. And so much of the time during this war, as he did as recently as today, as people were listening, any questions about operational details, even the questions about this comment from the general on the ground in Iraq about how the enemy that the U.S. Forces are facing is not the one they war gamed for. Fleischer refers those right to the Department of Defense and does his best to deflect any such questioning.
Don, we got the two-minute warning that the president would start speaking about a minute and a half ago. And for those of you who joined us late, and maybe most of you by this point, remind us, the president is in the East Room of the White House, where he'll be addressing which veterans organizations again?
It's called Veterans Service Organizations. It includes groups like the American Legion and the National Association of Black Veterans and the Vietnam Veterans of America and the VFW. And he'll be talking about sacrifice and service, and he'll be talking about his view of the Iraqi leadership.
And this is one of those moments in a president's leadership. The president of the United States, after going to Camp David and being out of the view last weekend, has been in view this weekend. This week, he was, as we mentioned earlier, at MacDill Air Force Base, the headquarters of Central Command, for an appearance there on Tuesday. Then he was at an appearance, went back to Camp David, and there was a joint news conference with Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, who visited him at Camp David for just a couple of hours and then stayed over, and they held a joint news conference in the rather rustic surroundings of Camp David there the following afternoon, and he since returned to the White House, and now here he is in the East Room of the White House, President of the United States.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Winston Churchill's great words,
"The president is being introduced,"
when facing the gales of tyranny, are worth remembering today. If we stand up to the enemy now, the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world may one day sink into the abysses of a new dark age. Setting and holding to a course towards the sunlit uplands of a freer and safer world.
This is Anthony Principi, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
To decisively shape events rather than merely experience them. And the compassion to understand that freedom depends upon the commitment of the men and women wearing the uniform of our great nation. America is blessed with such a leader, ladies and gentlemen, George W. Bush, President of the United States.
Good job. Thank you all. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming, and welcome to the People's House. It's my honor to welcome distinguished veterans to the White House. Especially pleased to have met with leaders from the veterans organizations at this crucial time for our country. The men and women who've worn the nation's uniform set an example of service and an example of sacrifice for future generations. And the current generation of our military is not letting us down. Today's armed forces are upholding the finest traditions of our country and of our military. They are making great progress in the war in Iraq. They are showing great courage, and they're making this country proud. I'm honored that Tony Principi introduced me. I'm proud of his service to our country, not only as a Vietnam vet, but now as the head of the Veterans Affairs, Department of Veterans Affairs. He's doing a really good job. I want to thank the national commanders and presidents of our National Veterans Service Organizations for coming. I want to thank you all for your service to your fellow Americans. Appreciate your members being here with us. Particularly pleased that Brian Thacker, a Medal of Honor recipient, is with us as well. I want to thank all our vets. I want to thank all the vets who are here. You're here at a time when our coalition, the United States and our partners, are acting together in a noble purpose. We're out to keep the peace, to make the world more peaceful, to make our nation and other nations more secure. And we're going to free the people of Iraq from the clutches of Saddam Hussein and his murderous allies. We are sending a clear signal to the world that we will not submit to a future in which dictators and terrorists can arm and threaten the peace without consequence. We are enforcing the demands of the United Nations, and we refuse to leave the Iraqi people in slavery under Saddam Hussein. When the war in Iraq is won, all who have joined this cause will be able to say to the Iraqi people, we were proud to fight for your freedom. The regime that once terrorized all of Iraq now controls a small portion of that country. Coalition troops continue their steady advance and are drawing near to Baghdad. We're inflicting severe damage on enemy forces. We are now fighting the most desperate units of the dictator's army. Fierce fighting currently underway will demand further courage and further sacrifice. Yet we know the outcome of this battle. The Iraqi regime will be disarmed. The Iraqi regime will be removed from power. Iraq will be free. In the last week, we have seen the brutal and cruel nature of a dying regime. In areas still under its control, the regime continues its rule by terror. Prisoners of war have been brutalized and executed. Iraqis who refuse to fight for the regime are being murdered. Some in the Iraqi military have pretended to surrender and then open fire on coalition forces that were willing to show them mercy. Given the nature of this regime, we expect such war crimes, but we will not excuse them. War criminals will be hunted relentlessly and judged severely. In the last week, we've also seen the nature of the young men and women who fight on our behalf. Coalition forces have begun delivering food and water to liberated parts of Iraq. I was pleased to hear today that the United Nations Security Council acted to resume food and medical supplies under the existing UN program, which will bring urgent relief to millions of Iraqis. We care about the human condition of the people who have suffered under Saddam Hussein. We provided $60 million to the World Food Program to help get this humanitarian effort up and running. We're shipping hundreds of thousands of metric tons of food to Iraq. In every possible way, coalition forces are showing kindness and respect to the Iraqi people. They're going to extraordinary lengths to spare the lives of the innocent. We treat wounded Iraqi soldiers. The contrast could not be greater between the honorable conduct of our forces and the criminal acts of the enemy. Every Iraqi atrocity has confirmed the justice and the urgency of our cause. Against this enemy, we will accept no outcome except complete victory. To meet this outcome, we must give our armed services the support and the resources they require. As veterans, all of you understand the importance of a well-supplied and well-trained fighting force. I've asked Congress for a nearly $75 billion wartime supplemental appropriations bill. This funding would provide fuel for ships and aircraft and tanks, supplies for our troops in the theater of operations, new high-tech munitions to replace the ones we have used in this war. The supplemental would also provide funds to assist in the reconstruction of Iraq and to help protect the American homeland in this time of high alert. I want to thank the veterans groups for their strong support, unwavering support for this wartime supplemental, and I call upon the United States Congress to pass the supplemental as quickly as possible. I also appreciate all the veterans are doing for America's military families in time of hardship. I appreciate your compassion. Across our country, local chapters of the American Legion, for example, are stepping forward to help those families in practical ways, from making household repairs to helping with child care. Members of the VFW and Auxiliary are sending care packages with baby supplies to military families. Operation Uplink program is helping thousands of service members keep in touch with their loved ones. Both the American Legion and the VFW are working with the USA Freedom Corps on a project called On the Home Front. This effort will match Americans who want to volunteer their times and skills with the military families who need help. Because of all this generosity, our men and women serving overseas will know that their loved ones are not facing this time alone. I want to thank the veterans groups for understanding the compassion needed to help those who are here wondering and worrying about their loved ones overseas. The people who serve in the military are giving their best to this country, and we have the responsibility to give them our full support. our full support not only here in Washington, D.C., but our support all across the country. I want to thank each veteran here today and across our land for the lifetime of service you have given our nation. I thank you for standing behind the men and women of today's armed forces as they fight for the liberty of an oppressed people, for the security of the United States and our friends and allies, and for the peace of the world. May God bless our troops.
President Bush shaking hands with the Secretary for Veterans Affairs, Anthony Principi, and then with the leaders of the veterans organizations gathered there in the East Room of the White House, an event that got underway a little bit later than had been expected, but the president delivering a message to the veterans. We refuse to leave the Iraqi people in slavery, he said, and then he went on to speak at some length about the treatment of American prisoners of war. War crimes, he said, cannot be excused. Those who commit them, he said, will be hunted relentlessly. The war crimes that have been committed thus far, he said, speak to the justice and urgency of our cause. Against this enemy, he said, we will accept no outcome except complete victory. That to tremendous applause. Then he called on the Congress of the United States to quickly pass the supplemental, that is a $75 billion request, most of it for military supplies that he presented to Congress earlier in the week, and that is pending now before both houses of Congress. James Fallows, a national correspondent with the Atlantic Monthly, is here. And James Fallows, there are a couple of different narratives going here, one of which we've heard again from the president about these atrocities and that sort of thing. And yet today, reports an Iraqi doctor is quoted as saying 55 people killed in an explosion in a Baghdad market. We have not confirmed that, but that's being reported on several news agencies. We're trying to find out our best. But these two stories are playing out simultaneously in many parts of the world. This is going to be offsetting each other, isn't it?
It is, and it's fascinating to think about whether the increasing administration's stress on the outrage about the treatment of U.S. prisoners and some of the unfair tactics the Iraqi soldiers are using, whether this reflects genuine, sincere, quote, naive, unquote, outrage that people could behave this way, or whether this is in fact a kind of counteroffensive to what they must be seeing in the Arab media in particular about, quote, war crimes, unquote, by the U.S.
And continues to raise charges about the treatment of Taliban prisoners who were not accorded a prisoner of war status by the United States and who find themselves in a limbo, in Guantanamo, being held with no recourse to they are being visited by the Red Cross, but no recourse to lawyers or any idea when they might be released. Anyway, Jim Fallows of the Atlantic Monthly, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've been listening to a special report from NPR News. To see and hear more war coverage, please go to npr.org. You'll find collections of commentaries and essays, extended interviews, reading lists, and other resources. And stay tuned to this public radio station for the latest on the war in Iraq. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Coming up a little bit later this hour, Ira Flatow joins us to talk about the science of biochemical weapons, both in the lab and on the battlefield, and a severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, new fears as that mystery disease spreads. But first, we're going to keep our focus on the war. We're joined now by Bei Fong, who's covering northern Iraq for U.S. News and World Report. He is in Cham Chamal in the Kurdish-controlled area of northern Iraq, but right next to the Iraqi front line. And Bei Fong, good of you to speak with us tonight.
Hi, good to be here.
And I apologize. I understand that there was shelling in Cham Chamal earlier today.
There's actually continued shelling right now. I can hear it along the ridge where the Iraqis actually withdrew from their old bunkers, their old frontline positions. It is coming from the direction of Kirkuk, and they are shelling the areas that they just vacated. The Kurdish Peshmerga say that this is an old Iraqi trick of retreating and then shelling the positions that they have just retreated from.
So did this shelling then come as a surprise?
It did. It came as a surprise. There was not much damage inflicted. I think it was more of a message because the Peshmergas had you know, erupted in celebration all of today. There were people rushing up the ridge, looting the old bunkers, firing guns into the air in celebration.
Mm-hmm. How much damage did this shelling do and or is doing?
Not much, as I said. It reached the edge of town. There was one 11-year-old boy who was injured, not severely. But other than that, it basically broke a few windows, and that's about it.
There have been reports of U.S. Special Forces up in this Kurdish area for quite some time, and then members of the 173rd Airborne arrived earlier this week in a parachute drop. Are any of those troops nearby?
I have not seen any here today. I saw them by the airstrip that they had just secured yesterday, but that's about 3 hours away from this frontline area. Today, they were being taken in Kurdish Peshmerga trucks to undisclosed locations. So it's assumed that they were going to frontline positions somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, American authorities have made it very clear that they really don't want Kurdish forces to return to Kirkuk, the oil-rich city in northern Iraq, not too far from where you are. Given their enthusiasm, as you described it earlier, in rushing across to seize these evacuated bunkers, are they going to be expected to comply with this request?
Well, it's interesting. It's hard to tell now. The top Kurdish generals are very eager to be seen as team players, and so they've made it very clear that they will not do anything unilaterally, that they will follow the order from the American commanders when they come. But now and then they do let slip, you know, this is our land, we are just going back to the land that belongs to us. But today they said they are letting the villagers go, and the Peshmergas are not actually securing any area. They are just basically providing security for these villagers who are going back to the villages that they came from.
Yet many Kurds were driven away from the city of Kirkuk years ago in Saddam Hussein's Arabization program, and certainly the Peshmergas could say much the same if those people wanted to return to their homes in Kirkuk.
That's right. I heard it referred to today as the Al-Quds, or Jerusalem of Kurdistan. Some of the Kurdish Peshmerga generals have taken to using a new phrase, though. They use a new phrase for their suppressed hopes, which is instead of saying Inshallah, which means God willing, they actually say Inshabush, meaning that it is still Bush's will whether or not they're able to go back to their homeland of Kirkuk.
One area that has been under attack in the Kurdish-controlled area is controlled by a group called Ansar al-Islam, an Islamic fundamentalist group. U.S. air and Tomahawk cruise missile attacks on that enclave earlier this week. There are reports today that Kurdish forces, the Peshmergas, say they have been in combat there. Have you heard any confirmation of that?
Yes, after a pretty massive air attack early this morning around dawn, about 5,000 Peshmerga forces backed up by special forces, American special forces, swept through the villages, or about a dozen or so that constituted Ansar's stronghold in the mountains. So they swept through and cleared the area of Ansar. It's still unclear how many Ansar fighters were killed. Many of them were basically driven into the mountains, which are along the Iranian border.
So what may be found there by U.S. Special Forces and the Peshmergas in terms of intelligence? Because earlier we've heard reports from American officials that if they went into those areas, they would look for intelligence, whatever they could find. So, and the fate of the Ansar al-Islam fighters remains to be seen. Beifong, thank you very much. I know it's very late there. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Beifong is with U.S. News and World Report. She is currently covering the conflict in northern Iraq. What some hoped would be a short and swift campaign in Iraq is turning out to be rather more complicated. Iraqi forces are fighting harder and more effectively than some Pentagon officials had expected. Joining us now is Michael Knights, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He specializes in Iraqi military and security affairs, and he's with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Good of you to join us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on NPR.
It seems the United States may have underestimated the Iraqis' forces' will to fight. At least the one of the land force commanders in Iraq was quoted as saying that in the papers this morning. What is the strategy of the Iraqis, considering that they cannot match a conventional U.S. military power?
Well, we've seen a lot of what's known as asymmetric warfare in the Iraqi response so far. Generally pitting their strengths against our weaknesses. This has been evident in a number of different ways. The first is to use rear area attacks against the logistics forces of the Americans, to ambush convoys, to disperse irregular forces amongst the civilian community and generally mask themselves. The other has been to make innovative use of terrain and weather, such as the attack we saw in the sandstorm the other day, which succeeded in knocking out a number of American tanks.
Well, you mentioned asymmetrical warfare. We've heard a great deal about this in the past several years. What do people mean by that? Is this another reference to guerrilla warfare?
Yes, though it doesn't necessarily have to involve guerrilla forces. You could have two conventional forces who fight each other in asymmetric ways. For instance, one side could shield themselves within urban areas, as we see the Iraqis doing, whereas we have avoided urban areas. We're out in the open. They prevent clear identification of themselves as military forces. They rely more on low technology than on our high technology. They attempt to defeat our use of air power by filling the air full of smoke, hiding their units within amongst civilian vehicles and urban areas.
Given a campaign designed around those lines, aren't at least allegations that the other side is not fighting fair? Don't these trace back to every use of guerrilla tactics or asymmetrical tactics by any force in history?
Yes, that's certainly true. I would say that to say the Iraqis aren't fighting fair, in some cases this could be traced to violations against international law. International law is often attempted to maintain non-combatant immunity, and some of the actions the Iraqis are either purposefully taking or are taking because their forces are generally not particularly well uniformed and do look like irregular forces, like civilian forces. A lot of the actions they're taking will endanger Iraqi civilians. We're probably going to see a loosening of some of the rules of engagement, which have been very strict at the moment on coalition forces. And that loosening will have the effect that a number of Iraqi civilians will probably be killed in incidents where they are mistaken for irregular forces of the regime.
And might not that be one of the goals of the Iraqi paramilitaries?
Certainly. It's often been suggested that the Iraqis have shielded themselves within civilian communities, not just to deter attacks on them, and we're thinking now of the air defense system during the long no-fly zones. They shielded their radars and their surface-to-air missiles within civilian communities, not just to deter attacks, but also so that they could exploit incidents of collateral damage.
Now, you talk about asymmetrical, taking advantage of your enemy's weaknesses. From the Iraqi point of view, does the U.S. and British concern over civilian casualties, is that a weakness?
Yes, from a military standpoint, it is a weakness. And, I mean, it's a weakness from the U.S. standpoint as well. U.S. military commanders are well aware of the limitations that strict rules of engagement place on them. A good example might be the recent ambush in which a strong U.S. Apache helicopter force tried to engage Republican Guard, found it enmeshed within urban and semi-urban areas close to what might have been civilian housing, were not able to engage this force properly and subsequently had to suffer very heavy fire.
Now, there have also been a battle for perception, and everybody will remember the picture that Iraqi television released of a downed Apache with farmers waving their rather antique rifles over their heads, and the claim by the Iraqi ministry that the Apache was brought down by a farmer firing a fowling piece or something like that. Are the Iraqis doing better in terms of this information war?
Well, it's interesting to see what kind of transition we've had in the media war. It is an intensely psychological war in which the media is vital. The first thing to say about this is that in the pre-war period, we focused a lot on the use of offensive psychological operations. We were on the offensive using media, radio broadcasts being put into Iraq to try and break down Iraqi civil and military morale, and to try and negate Iraqi civilians as a possible force of combatants. Now we're in the war, what we find is that we're on the defensive in the media. We have to disprove Iraqi allegations of collateral damage, or we have to accept them and explain them. So it's naturally in these kind of operations that we've been forced onto the defensive now in the media war.
There is another front, if you will, diplomacy. Iraqi diplomats are still accredited to many places, and of course including the United Nations. We saw an attempt by some Arab states to bring a resolution before the Security Council. They've apparently decided better with that. They would regard a loss of a vote there as being a bad defeat. But what is Iraq trying to do in terms of its diplomatic strategy?
Well, the one thing that they'll definitely try and do is to try and exploit any kind of operational pause that happens at this moment. And what I mean by that is a pause outside Baghdad in which we marshal forces, we allow our logistical elements to catch up, and we give the troops some degree of respite before we push them into this heavily defended area. This is naturally in any military operation. They tend to occur in bounds. The Iraqis will attempt to exploit this politically. We already see people like Saudi Arabia asking for ceasefires, possibly attempting to reopen negotiations. And if there was an operational pause outside Baghdad, pressure would be very strong.
Just a minute or so left, but if you can look back at the 91 campaign, Desert Storm, what do you think the Iraqis have learned from that conflict?
Well, they've clearly learned from that conflict that engaging in force-on-force meetings against the U.S. military, as they tried to do in Kuwait, is a very bad idea indeed. As with the Iraqis, though, often what's interesting is what they haven't learned. Recently, we've seen a lot of movement, strategic or tactical movement, where they've been moving large amounts of units. This is an extremely bad idea for the Iraqis. It's a real no-win situation. The more they move, the more they expose themselves to air power. On one final issue, you mentioned underestimation.
And very
quickly.
Beginning.
I think we always fight the last war, but one of the things that has informed us more than the last war was the 1991 uprisings immediately after the Gulf War. This is the reason why we thought the Iraqi military wouldn't fight and that the regime would collapse so quickly.
Michael Knights, thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
Michael Knights, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to New York, where Ira Flatow, the host of Science Friday, has a discussion of the mysterious illness known as SARS, that and the latest news on the war in Iraq coming up after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.